Rex, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Jennifer Hickson from the Moth's artistic team, and I'll be your host this time. This hour, we're going to hear seven stories from Moth Story Slams around the country. At Story Slams, people show up with a true story that reflects their interpretation of the theme for the night. As you'll hear, people get creative. In this hour, we're going to hear about Bible school, corporate pep talks, fantasy meals, basketball, decluttering, and this first story involving criminal mischief in the fourth degree. Alan Gordon told this story at a slam with the theme mystery. Here's Alan live at the Moth in New York City.
So you might not suspect from looking at me that I lead a double life. By day, I'm a criminal defense lawyer, a public defender with the Legal Aid Society here in the city. The room is filled with my clients, apparently. But at night, I write mysteries. I've got stories in Ellery Queen, Alfred Hitchcock, a series from St. Martin's, and a musical called Girl Detective. But where did this come from? The mystery love I have goes back to when I was in second grade. The first mysteries I read, I don't know if anybody remembers these, a brilliant boy detective named Encyclopedia Brown. And this book was filled with these short mysteries where the local police, who had the word baffled always in front of them, were stumped until Encyclopedia Brown would bicycle onto the scene and solve it like that. How did Encyclopedia Brown know that Farmer Gump killed Zeb? Can you figure it out? Turn to page 74. I could never figure it out. I always had to turn to page 74, but I grew up and became a lawyer and became a mystery writer. And you think that those two things would go together, but they don't. You don't have the Encyclopedia Brown moments as a criminal defense lawyers, despite what you see on television or in books. Because what we are handed is a case that the police think they've already solved. No mystery there. And then what you have to do as a defense lawyer, if you go to trial, is to show them that they're wrong. No, you didn't solve it. What we do, in essence, is we unsolve it. We restore the mystery. We let the innocent man go free. And you may never know what actually happened, and it doesn't matter. Because that's not what it's about. But all the years I've been doing this, all the trials I've had, I wanted that Encyclopedia Brown moment just once, and I finally got it in probably the least significant case I've ever tried. A man was accused of taking a paint can and throwing it through the upper floor window of his ex-landlord. Criminal mischief in the fourth degree, damage to property. It's a crime. It is. And the DAs so did not want to waste time on this that they offered to dismiss the case if we just pay for the damn window. And this guy had a record. It wouldn't have mattered to his life except that he was, and there are such people, a man of principle. He says, I did not break that window. I'm not paying for it. I don't care if I have to go to trial. I don't even care if I have to go to jail. And the thing that made it even cooler is that there might have been a woman involved. His ex-girlfriend may have been up in that very bedroom with the landlord, which would have given him a motive. Least significant case in my career, and boy, I wanted to try this one. And we have a jury trial. We're wasting the vast resources of New York City on this case. But you see, it's about the principle. This is important. And I was there with my vast experience against some kid DA, as happens, and he didn't do the thing that I did, which was to talk to the cop. He never even was going to call the cop. He was going to call the landlord. He would say, I saw the paint can coming through the window, and I looked out, and there was your client, you know. But I had talked to the cop, and I realized that I had the Encyclopedia Brown information that the DA did not. Rarely do you see this happen, a defense lawyer calling the police officer as a witness for the defense. And I asked her, because I knew the answers to these questions, did you recover the paint can? And she said no, because the landlord wouldn't let me into the bedroom and I never did see the paint can. And I said to her, and this was the moment, did you see the broken window? Yes, I did. And where was the broken glass? It was on the outside. An entire jury leaned forward and went, huh. Now, I have had cases where people were looking at life in jail. The most serious crimes you could possibly imagine. I have pulled enormous rabbits out of really tiny hats, but you know something? Of all the cases I've ever had in my life, that acquittal was the most fun. Thank you very much.
That was Alan Gordon. He's been a public defender with the New York City Legal Aid Society for nearly 30 years. He's a prize-winning librettist and lyricist and the author of 8 mystery novels and many short stories. And it all started with Encyclopedia Brown. Our next story is from Jen Lee. She's originally from Colorado, where this story takes place. The theme was fish out of water. Here's Jen Lee, live at the Story Slam.
Going to my parents' house is like going to an amusement park, and my girls want the all-access grandkid pass. They want grandpa's special pancakes, they want the free lollipops from grandma's bank, and they want to go to Sunday school. And when I became a parent, Sunday school wasn't a problem. I was happy to have my faith and to feel like I had answers for some of life's tough questions. But somewhere between the first baby and the second baby, I stopped believing all the answers. And we left our position helping to lead a church shortly before moving to New York. So before I visit home, I asked my husband, what should we do about Sunday school? And he said, I don't want them to go. But I'm always worried about being reactionary. So I said, well, what's the harm, really? It's just once a year, and it's just songs and crafts and stories. And so we let them go. The first week, they come home with full memorabilia. My oldest daughter, Amelia, has homework. She's 8. It has Bible verses on it, and she needs to return it the next week so her class can earn a pizza party. And my husband says, you do realize you won't be here for the pizza party, right? We'll be back in New York. And she said, I know, but if I could help someone else earn a pizza party, I want to do what I can. And we look at each other and we just think, that's our girl. And the other thing they're both very excited about are the Bible bucks. And if there's two words that should never go in a sentence together, it's Bible and bucks. And what they go on to describe sounds like church meets Chuck E. Cheese. And the second week, they come home with a brown paper bag with their treasures they bought with their Bible bucks, little plastic parachute guys and the like. And I think at first, like, that was fine, that was okay. Until a few hours later, out of the corner of my eye, I see Amelia pick up my mom's large leather Bible and sneak upstairs. And she's gone a really long time, so long that my mom's like, maybe you should go check on her. And I go up, and sure enough, she's poring over it. And I check if she's okay, and she says, yeah. And I tell her dinner is ready, and a few minutes she follows me back downstairs, this time with a different Bible in hand. It's an orange pocket-sized New Testament, like the kind that Christians use when they witness to non-believers. And she sits down at the table with it, and my relatives are milling about. My mom's setting food on the table, and she flips to the back in the end papers where there's a sinner's prayer with a place for your name and the date. And this is so that when you pray the sinner's prayer and become saved from eternal damnation, you can write your name and the date so you remember that you did that. But she doesn't know, so she says, Mom, if I had a Bible like this, is this where I'd put my birth date? And I said, no, not exactly. But I don't want to have a conversation in front of all my devout relatives. So we move on, and I volunteer to tuck her in at night because I know there are things to say. And we start to talk, and I can tell she's trying to figure out the system and bend herself to fit. And it looks really strange on her, but it's so familiar to me because this is how I've lived my whole life. like Catherine Zeta-Jones in Entrapment when she's the burglar. And she has that full body black suit and she's contorting herself like over and under a room full of laser beam alarms. Like that's how life has felt for me. And I don't want that for her. And so I say, you know, you don't have to believe everything they say. Some people believe it and some people don't. And your dad and I used to, and now, you know, not so much. And she said, what do you mean? What don't you believe? And I said, well, these words that somebody added in on the end papers, that if you magically say them, it's the only way you get to go to heaven when you die. I don't believe that's true. I say, but you're 8 and you don't have to have this figured out. You don't have to worry about it. And my attempts to comfort her totally backfire. And she starts to cry. And then she starts to sob. And I scoop her into my arms, even though her limbs are almost as long as mine are now. And I'm like rocking her like she's still a baby. And she's saying, I don't know what to believe anymore. I don't know what's true. And it's never occurred to her before this moment that you could believe something and have it not be true. And suddenly everything she's ever believed in her whole life, from Santa Claus to the Tooth Fairy to the Nativity story, like it's all on the table. It's all up for grabs. And she says, I just want to believe what you believe and what Dad believes and Grandpa and Grandma and the Christian religion. And then she tells me what else happened at Sunday school. And she said, Mom, on the first day when the teacher asked me in front of everybody if I usually go to church back home, when I said no, half the kids in the class gasped. And the shame that she felt in that moment is like fresh on her face. And I'm really clear that what happened was that a line was drawn, a circle of belonging, and she was clearly outside of it. And with every homework sheet and Bible book and scripture reading, she's been trying to work her way back in. And we do this with belonging. We collapse it into other things, like belief systems and group memberships. But what if it could be granted all on its own? So I tell her to lay down and to close her eyes, and I start to stroke her long blonde hair. And I say, you belong to me. You belong to your dad. You belong to your sister and to your grandma and to your grandpa. And now I'm not just talking to her, but I'm talking to the 8-year-old in me that's still wondering if I still get to belong to these people, even though I don't believe the way I used to anymore. And I try to believe it too. Thank you.
That was Jen Lee. Jen is the director and producer of Indie Kindred, a documentary about creative collaboration among independent artists. You can check out the trailer for the film at themoth.org. In a moment, we'll hear how to write speeches for a CEO, how to plan your last meal, and how to cope as the coach of the losing team.
Support for The Moth comes from Babbel, an interactive language program that teaches travel, business, and casual conversation skills in a new language, including Spanish. Available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jennifer Hickson. Our next story is from Karen Duffin. The theme was trust.
Okay. So I was the speechwriter for the CEO of a very large company for several years. And the thing about being a speechwriter is that it isn't just about being able to write well. It's kind of like being a professional best friend. You kind of have to be able to like finish their sentences. You have to be able to channel their voices. And so you spend a lot of time together. You travel a lot together. You learn how to speak in their voice. Also, if you happen to be able to afford a speechwriter, you're probably pretty busy. So these people, we might go to 4 or 5 countries in 1 week. We'd get on the airplane. He'd be like, "Where are we going?" I'm like, "We're going to Saudi Arabia." And you'd pull out all the materials and teach him how to say hello in Arabic. And so he's placing an enormous amount of trust in you to be able to pronounce things correctly and tell him GDPs and things like this. So you spend several years building up this kind of trust. And I've seen people fail, not for lack of talent, but for lack of ability to build a relationship. So I stumbled on this job. It was a complete accident. And I was a couple years into it, somehow managed to survive it, when I was assigned to write the speech for the annual shareholder meeting. And this is the most important audience for a public company. It's the people who buy and sell your stock. So if you get up on stage and you have baggy eyelids or you say something particularly fantastic and you didn't mean to, your stock could go up or it could go down. So the actual trick for a shareholder speech is to sort of do nothing. It's to stand very, very still. And it's like, I think about it like the doctor's word, you know, the oath you take is to do no harm. So as the speechwriter for the shareholder speech, you're supposed to kind of just do no harm. So I had worked very hard. He was very, very stressed that week. And so I had worked very hard to make everything good, and he was settled. And so we sit down that night to finish it up. And I never drove him to or from anything, but for some reason this night I drove him home and dropped him off and said, "Okay, here's your speech. You're going to be great." You also end up kind of being like a second grade teacher, like, "You're really, really good. You're going to do great tomorrow." Right? And he's like 52 and he's a billionaire, but whatever. So they need encouragement too, trust me. So he was like, you know, they're seldom ever off, even when they're not in front of a crowd, but he kind of like exhaled and he said, "Oh my God, I'm so grateful that you like really prepared really hard because I've been really stressed." I was like, "No problem, I got it." So I drop him off. I say, "I'm going to pick you up at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. We're going to go to rehearse and you're going to be great." So I go home, finish this script, send it off to the producers. I go to sleep, set like 6 alarms just in case, and for 5 o'clock in the morning. And I wake up the next morning to without the alarm, which is strange, because I never wake up without the alarm. And there's sunlight streaming through the windows. And I'm thinking, that is so weird. I mean, I'm in California. I'm not in Alaska. Like, why is there sunlight? And then it's that movie moment where, like, they're, like, the audience, like, you guys would be screaming right now, "No." And in my head, I'm screaming, "No." And I'm like in slow motion, like, leaping out of my bed, like, probably tucking and rolling and grabbing my cell phone. And it's 7:30. And he goes on stage at 8 o'clock in the morning. So remember, do no harm, like, don't make him feel frazzled. So I go completely zen at this point. I'm like, there's no possible lie that I could have for why I didn't pick someone up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Like, nothing happens before 6. So I have literally, I have like 3 alarms going off silently because I had turned my phone on silent so that I wouldn't disrupt the rehearsal the night before. There's also probably 22 text messages, 12 voicemails, some of which are from him, and he's seriously like the nicest man on earth, which is what makes this story so much worse, because he's like a father who's not angry, he's disappointed in you. He's like, "Hi, Karen, it's 6:04 or like 6:12, and I assume maybe your car broke. I don't know. I'm just going to drive myself," right? So I have like 6 of these voicemails. So I call my boss, and I'm just going to tell her to. I'm like, "I slept through that. I don't know what I'm going to do." And she says, "It's okay. I'm just so glad you're alive, because John had to stop rehearsal this morning and tell everyone he's very," that's his name, John, "I'm very, very sorry that I'm so, like, off today and so flustered, because I think that one of my communications people died." Like, I don't know where she is. And I am like, I'm probably sobbing silently at this point. And she says, I'd really love to talk more, but I need to call the Palo Alto Police Department because they're headed to your house right now to make sure that you're not dead. And I say, okay, that's great, I'll go. So I throw everything on, I get in the car and I'm driving. And the other person who spends a lot of time with you and the CEO is his bodyguard. So his bodyguard's like my father at this point, and he's very silly despite being large and frightening to everybody else. So I call him on the way to the speech, and I'm like, Chris, oh my God, are you at the convention center? Does everyone hate me? At which point, he gives like a really big yawn, and he goes, oh man, is there something going on today? And I hung up the phone and kept driving. So anyway, I get to the convention center, and most speeches that I did for him were for audiences of complete strangers. I would never see them again. We were in the country, out of the country, whatever. This was an audience of everyone who mattered to my career, all the executives in the company, all of the communications department, everybody's there. So it's like, picture your worst personal walk of shame. This is like a professional walk of shame. And I'm like, everybody knows, because first of all, they thought I was dead. And now they know I'm alive and that I just slept in like I'm 17. And so I walk in, I wait for him to finish his speech, and I kind of tiptoe up to him, and I'm like, he's talking to an analyst, you know, the people who buy and sell our stock. And he interrupts the conversation, and he says, and he's from West Virginia, so this is how it goes. I'm sorry, I have to stop. I have to give this girl a hug. And so he stops his conversation with the analyst and gives me the biggest bear hug ever to all the world. We look loving and having a reunion, and he whispers in my ear, I'm going to kill you. So what I learned is that if you're going to be late, be so late that they're not angry. They're just happy you're alive.
That was Karen Duffin. She's a writer and radio producer. To see a picture of Karen with the CEO and his director of protective services, visit themoth.org. By the way, they're all still friends. Next up is Alvin Lau from our Story Slam series in Chicago, where we partner with public radio station WBEZ. The theme was firsts, and this was Alvin's first time at the Moth.
I've never been on death row, but I thought about my last meal, as I imagine most of you have, having watched prison documentaries and enough primetime cable. And so when you do the last meal thought exercise, essentially what you do is in your brain, you go back in time to all of your happiest culinary moments, and you take all of your favorite foods and you gather them together for this like epic finale, which kind of becomes a spectrum of your tastes over the years, kind of like your life flashing before your tongue. I would have shrimp tempura, because that shit's delicious. And I'm kind of a fat kid at heart. I'd have jerk chicken, because I had it one time with my dad when we used to get along, and he knew so much about jerk chicken and how Bill Clinton liked to eat it. And every time I taste it, it reminds me of him and Bill Clinton. I have my mom's sweet and sour meatballs, which is my most favorite memory, and I used to think that they were manna from heaven, but it turns out it was just ketchup, vinegar, and like a pound of sugar, which was delicious. And then I'd have my own macaroni and cheese, which is the best in the world, which I make with sour cream, and it has the burnt cheddar edges. And I imagine that in my last meal, I pour the sweet and sour meatballs over them, because that shit would be delicious, and I'm a fat kid at heart. After 6 weeks of chemo, I dropped from 168 pounds for 152. And that's not that extreme given the circumstances, but after the first time I weighed myself, I never wanted to do that again. I'm too good with numbers. I turn the pounds into ounces and grams, and I always calculate how much weight I've lost, how far I am from when I used to live my previous healthy life when I could walk to the corner store and not feel like I got off of a treadmill. I was so tired. It was just aches and grogginess and the blur of night terrors and nosebleeds. They never tell you about those. There'd be times when I wake up in a pool of my own hot, warm blood and I didn't know what was happening, and it was so scary. And there'd be times when I'd do laundry and I'd find these copper-colored stains on the inside of my shirts and I didn't know what they were. And it took me a while to realize that that's nose blood. And that's a really personal and eerie thing. I was always hungry. In the sense that I wanted to eat. But my body didn't want anything, even though I still needed the calories to recover. Every time I ate, it was like trying to swallow sand. My doctor was 70-something, and he kind of reminded me of John Lithgow with a hunchback. And he was so adorable. When I told him how I was feeling, he was just like, you know, there's this drug that's not legal in every state that will kind of give you the munchies. And I told him I knew about pot because I'm an artist after all. I wasn't hungry, even though I wanted to be. So all I ate was plain oatmeal that I would prepare by the tubful. And when you're not hungry, it tastes like warm snot. And it sounds funny, but it wasn't. All I wanted was a cheeseburger. Not even to actually eat the cheeseburger. Thinking about that made me nauseous all the time. I just wanted to want a cheeseburger. To feel my body processing that hunger. To want to thrive and grow and not just fall off and shuffle off quietly. I wanted to remember what it felt like to salivate over something. Some of the things you take for granted. When the oncologist called, the lilt in his voice hinted at good news. And it was. The tumor had shrunk to an operable size. And while nothing in life is ever guaranteed, my chances looked really good. So I had the surgery, and they began to wean me off the treatments. And eventually I could start eating again, soups, bananas. And eventually it came time where I could eat a real meal again. And my closest friends say that they would take me anywhere I wanted. I didn't have shrimp tempura or jerk chicken. I ended up getting Thai food. Bad Thai food. like comfort food Thai. Like Thai food that reminds you of Times Square, like Americanized and too sugary. Fat kid till I die. I'll never have a last meal. I'd like to think that my death will be less predictable than that. But as I was sitting there with all of my closest friends, looking down at the menu like a list of wishes, I was so grateful just to be hungry. And I realized that it didn't matter if the pork was going to be overcooked or if the chef was going to be heavy-handed with the basil. All that mattered was that I had a chance to have a first meal. A meal that I could point to and say, that's when I came back to life. Thank you.
That was Alvin Lau, live in Chicago. Alvin is a 3-time International Poetry Slam champion and professional poker player. His favorite food will always be his mother's sweet and sour meatballs. Our next story comes from a story slam in Louisville, Kentucky, where we partner with public radio station WFPL. Chris Rashid had never been to a story slam before, but threw his name in the hat. The theme was the finish line. Here's Chris Rashid, live at the story slam.
How does one outrace fear, a failure, and turn that into victory? And how does one measure the finish line as it pertains to victory or lack of victory? I was a basketball coach and I taught school and I still teach school, but in 2008, I didn't know anything about coaching basketball, but I lied and said I did. So they allowed me to be the coach of the basketball team. I didn't know any plays, I didn't know anything. I knew I liked basketball and I watched basketball. So I had these boys on the team, and I'm talking about I was in a rough, rough school, the roughest school in Jefferson County. I'm talking about kids flipping over tables, throwing computers out windows. I'm talking about rugged thugs that have, like, we're talking eighth graders with six packs, grills, and tattoos. And they're grabbing the rim and everything. And they're running like the wind, and they're just, they're failing. Their grades are horrible. Their behavior's horrible. Now, I'm trying to get this team together, and at the same time, I managed to piss off the principal. So the principal is kind of like making everything hard, everything hard. They're taking the grade sheets. They're making sure the kids make the GPA level. And so it's like trying to get eligibility. It's trying to get people to do the right thing. And I'm trying to learn plays and put this team together. So this principal, and I'm talking about fear and doubt and trying to reach this finish line of overcoming this overwhelming, embarrassing feeling that we suck. So every day we would lose by 25 points. I mean, we would get smacked. And it was like, and the principal just felt it was his duty to get on the intercom in the morning and announce the score. And it was like 0-1, 0-2, 0-3, 0-4. And I had this little boy that wanted to be on the team so bad. And I connect to this boy because, you know, he was like me. He was a loser. And he tried to make it onto the team, and he was about that tall, about 4 foot, 4.5 feet. And I'm talking about these other boys are like this tall, fast, and strong, and physical, and mean. And they used to bully this boy all the time. And the boy had some skills, but he just wasn't going to make the cut. But he never gave up. And I learned something from him, because as I watched him never give up, it gave me the strength and the courage to never give up. So this little boy didn't make the team, but he came up to me and he said, "Can I at least be a part of the team? Can I be the water boy? Can I be the manager?" And I was so impressed with him, I allowed him to be that. And I remember how the boys were so negative and they were always commenting, "Oh, Rashid's a horrible coach." And, you know, they didn't want to deal with the losing either. So they, like, projected their sorrow onto me. So I projected mine onto them. So... I started to have study hall. It's like, if you fail, you don't play. We're just going to have study hall in my room every day after practice. And so the boys did the work. And as I started to learn some plays, and I figured out if I could just make get their physicality involved, just 1-2-2 press the whole way through and just grind it out. And once they didn't have to think about anything, they became a beast. But we still kept losing. We had no discipline, and we just, every time we got down by a few points, they dropped their head. The boys' GPA started to climb and the eligibility was starting to take place, but their negative attitude, they kept talking negatively. And Little Holloway said, "Guys, remember what Coach said? It's about working together and being a family." And one of the boys, Michael, said, "Man, you the water boy. Go get us something to drink. We're thirsty. We wear the uniform. You don't wear the uniform." And the little boy came to me and he was in tears, and I was so outraged, because I remember I could relate to this little boy and being bullied and things like that. So I held a team meeting and I said, "Now you're the water boy and he wears the uniform." So I put the water boy on the team. And in practice, he got manhandled. Now he had skills, but I mean physically, it was no contest. So one day, we're 0-7. We're getting smacked again. And we're down by 25 at the end of the third quarter. The other team's high-fiving, and I'm trying to send in all these big bad dudes. I'm sending one in. They're turning the ball over. They're rolling off their feet. They look totally dejected. And I look down, and I just send in one tough, rugged guard after another, after another, after another, and they just keep failing. One guy called him. He didn't even want to go in the game. So I look at the water boy. I said, "Holloway, get in there." Holloway gets in the game. Everybody looks shocked that Holloway's in the game. So Holloway gets in the game, and they pass the ball to Holloway, and he goes to the right side of the three-point line, and he shoots, bang, three-point shot. Comes down, we get a steal, comes down the left side, he hits, bang, three-point shot. The boy hit four threes, he dribble penetrated, dished to the left, and the boys got so excited that they came back, and we lost by 3 points. But you gotta understand, coming from 25 down to 3 points was a major victory. And so we started winning after that. And we're talking about an 0-17 that ended up in the semifinals losing by 6 points with a 3.3 GPA. And that was an amazing accomplishment. But this little boy, he gave me this picture. He's on this picture right here. And he wrote on here, "You helped me. You changed my life." And what he didn't realize is that watching him in that journey, reaching his finish line, motivating me to reach my finish line, he changed my life.
That was Chris Rashid. Chris is an eighth grade language arts teacher. He's also a supervising teacher for a Saturday school, the Street Academy, which caters to at-risk boys. When we come back, two more stories, one about excessive hand washing and another about romantic memento hoarding.
Support for The Moth comes from Noom, offering a personalized weight loss program that uses psychology, small goals, and technology designed to help people change habits and keep the weight off for good at Noom, Noom.com.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
This is The Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jennifer Hickson from The Moth. Our last two stories are from our Grand Slam series, where previous winners compete for the ultimate title. This first one is from Kevin McAuliffe, and the theme was secret weapons.
I started washing my hands when I was 13 years old. Which may sound strange, but up until that point, I washed them like any normal person. And then all of a sudden, that just wasn't good enough. And I had to scrub them over and over again. It was like germs were an army that was out to get me, and soap and water were my only defense. And pretty fast, my hands got red and chapped, and I started holding them up here like a T-Rex just to avoid touching anything dangerous. And people started to notice because I would stand at the sink washing for as long as it took to prepare for surgery. And my family did whatever they could to try to help and understand and explain to me that there was nothing to worry about, but it was no use. I refused to go into my own bedroom for 3 months because I was sure there was something harmful in there. I didn't go to the barber shop because I feared the scissors. And I remember my dad did whatever he could to help. Every night he would go into my bedroom bravely and he would retrieve clean clothes for me. And then he would wash them a second time just to make sure I felt comfortable wearing them. My sister was a senior in high school at the time, and she tied my shoes for me so I didn't have to reach down and go near my shoes where, you know, I knew germs were out to attack. She even stood outside the bathroom while I took showers to time me so I didn't take too long on each limb, and I would try to cheat. My mom, she called my older brother up from college to see if he could help, but once he got home and he saw how much I'd changed and how debilitated I was, he just couldn't help but cry. I was a wreck. But my parents had one last idea, one last solution. They were going to send me alone into New York City. which was an interesting move because at the time I was pretty sure Manhattan was where germs were born. But I had another older brother there, Michael, who was the trailblazer in the family, and he had graduated from college and he was living the big life in New York City. And he was intense, and he was the best at whatever he did. When he came home, which wasn't too often, it was like a celebrity was back in town. And I think my parents wanted me to go there like that show Intervention. You know, they wanted him to be the one to get me out of this funk. And so they were sending me to the front lines, and I didn't know how I was going to make it back alive. I remember my mom drove me to the train station, and she was telling me the whole way how good of a time I was going to have with my older brother. So obviously desperate that I would at least be okay for a day or two. And I almost refused to get on the train to New York, but I knew how heartbroken she would be, so I forced myself in, and it took me a while, but I finally found a seat with the fewest stains on it. When I got to my brother's apartment, I just prayed that we would just stay there at least. But right away, he didn't ask me about my craziness, which was fine with me. I was tired of talking about it. He just said, "Kev, we're going out." And I said, "Well, hold on one second." And I went to the sink. And all he had was dishwashing fluid, unfortunately. But that would have to do. But when I reached for it, he just stopped my hand. He turned the faucet off and he said, "You're not washing your hands this weekend." And he was a lot older than me, and I wasn't used to saying no to him, so I just gulped, and I followed him out with these two scary hands at my side. But it was weird. We went out to dinner, and for the first time, I sort of felt normal again. I felt okay, even though there was New Jersey Transit germs on my fingertips. I was eating bread, and I was almost proud because I was sitting across from my brother, who was like this brave mercenary who was there to help me fight my war. So I was feeling pretty good, but then we walked back to his apartment. And I couldn't keep my eyes off of the sidewalk. It was like a minefield of spots, potentially dangerous spots. And I was really trying to avoid every single one, and I almost made it until I stepped on just some questionable spot on the ground. And immediately, my world stopped, and I started trying to figure out how I was going to get rid of the only shoes I brought. So we got back to his place, and he could see something was wrong, and I finally had to explain it to him, and he didn't respond. My brother just got up, picked up my shoe, turned it over, and he licked the sole. And he said, "Kev, I'm still alive." And then he sat back down, like William Wallace parading back into town. Like, yeah! And I felt great. And the next morning, I tied my shoes and I got back on that train. I wanted to give everyone a high five. He didn't cure me that night. My war would still go on for a while, but he did teach me how good it could feel to win a battle. Thank you.
That was Kevin McAuliffe. He's an educator in New York City, where he reports the sidewalks no longer make him nervous. Growing up, he loved going to school, and now he wants his students to feel the same way. Our final story today is from Kate Greathead. It's another Grand Slam story, and the theme was the tipping point.
So it was one of those breakups where all your stuff ends up in trash bags and you have like 5 minutes to find a new apartment. And once you do, the last thing you want to do is unpack those trash bags because they contain a lot of raw emotion. And so I let these trash bags full of my stuff sit in my car for a few months. And they would probably still be sitting there if it weren't for the fact that my car technically belonged to my little sister, who eventually returned from her trip in the Middle East. So, a brief portrait of my sister. Molly reads the international section of the New York Times every day, the entire thing. This past summer, she was the youngest delegate at the Democratic National Convention. On more than one occasion, she's lent me a large sum of money. So basically, in spite of the fact that she's 20 and I'm 30, she's the older sister. So Molly gets back from her trip, and naturally, she'd like her car back. And I really want to see her, and I really want to give her her car back. But I also really don't want to go all the way to the Upper West Side. And upon hearing this, Molly realizes she doesn't want to come all the way to Brooklyn. So we agree to meet in the middle on a corner outside of Grand Central Station at 7 o'clock that night. And when we make the plan, I have every intention of returning her car in the condition that she gave it to me, not full of trash bags. Just to explain, in the months since the breakup, I've managed to make a few trips to the car to fish out stuff I need for daily survival, clothes and electronics. So what remains in the bag is stuff I can live without, but stuff that's very, very important to me. For example, this one time, Ben and I had oysters, and it was very special, and I never wanted to forget it, so I kept some of the shells. And another time, we went swimming in a lake together, and it was very special, and I never wanted to forget it, so I took some rocks home. Some of my favorite memories of Ben are of just staying in and ordering pizza. And you, all these nights were very special, and I never wanted to forget a single one. So you know those little, like, plastic dollhouse tables that come free in a box of pizza? Those are also sitting in the back seat of my sister's car, buried in about 15 years worth of clothing that I don't wear anymore, but represents different eras of my life that I don't want to forget because it's my life. Also, who knows, I might have kids one day and they might want to dress up as me for Halloween. So I've always been a very sensitive, sentimental person, and it's not easy for me to like deal with this kind of stuff because it triggers deep, deep feelings. So I know it's not going to be easy to unload my sister's car, but I'm not worried because when we make the plan, it's the morning, and I have all day to do it. But as the day goes on, I start to get a little worried because I'm not doing it. And the next thing I know, it's 6:30 and I haven't done it. And in order to meet her on time on the corner, I have to leave right now. So I get in the car and we meet. And she jumps in the car and we hug. And I say, how is the Middle East? And I feel like a jerk because I think something big went down there while she was visiting. But I don't know exactly what because I haven't had a chance to read the international section in a little while. Anyway, Molly doesn't seem to hear the question. She's distracted by looking around her car. And all of a sudden, I feel ashamed. And I want to explain myself to her, but I also feel like there's no point because she's just going to think I have a problem. And I do. Which is that I keep on thinking one of these nights, Ben's going to buzz my buzzer, and I'm going to run downstairs and open the door and slam it on his face, and then wait a few seconds and open it again and jump in his arms, and my car will be packed and ready to go back home. But it's been 87 days, and that hasn't happened yet, and in the back of my mind is something that my hypnotherapist recently told me, which is that people cling to physical manifestations of what they can't have, or what they don't have. And also in the back of my mind is an Eleanor Roosevelt quote that you can do the thing that you're most afraid to do. And in this moment in the car with my sister, suddenly I know what I need to do, which is to get rid of all this stuff. But I also know myself, and I need to do it immediately before I start crying and change my mind. So Molly points out that throwing household garbage in public trash cans is against the law. And as much as I resent the labeling of my stuff as household garbage, I agree that to be safe, we should distribute the bulk among different trash cans in the Midtown area. And that is what we do. And Molly drives, and she pulls up to the curb, and I jump out, and I chuck a chapter of my life into the trash, and then I jump back in the car, and we head off to the next trash. And we repeat the process until the car is empty, except for one final item. A wicker basket that I found on the curb, you know, people leave stuff out for you to take, that looked like the perfect basket for collecting eggs in case Ben changed his mind about getting chickens for the backyard, which is not as ridiculous as it sounds. This is something people in Brooklyn do. There was an article about it in the style section. Ever since I was a little girl growing up in Manhattan, I've always had this lifelong dream of having chickens, so it wasn't easy for me to throw that basket away, but I did it. And I felt mature and practical and proud of myself, but not enough to stop myself from reaching back in the trash can and fishing it back out, because having thrown everything away, it's finally dawned on me that Ben is not going to be ringing my doorbell one of these nights, that we are over, which means I'm single. Which means that somewhere out there is the next person I fall in love with, and who knows, he just might share my dream of having chickens.
That was Kate Greathead. She's a writer who lives in Brooklyn, and yes, she still has the basket, but as of this recording, no chickens yet. To see a picture of Kate with her little sister, visit themoth.org. While you're there, check our website for upcoming main stage shows or story slams in your area. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next time for the Moth Radio Hour.
Your host this hour was Jennifer Hickson, senior producer of The Moth. Jennifer is the creative lead on the Moth Story Slam series in New York and around the country. The rest of the Moth directorial staff includes Catherine Burns, Sarah Haberman, Sarah Austin Jeunesse, and Meg Bowles, with production support from Jenna Weiss-Berman and Brandon Echter. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from Tahiti Boy and Mr. Wazo, The Goat Rodeo Sessions, Christopher Lennertz, Jamie Sieber, Evan Christopher, and Rog Billy Bop. The Moth is produced for radio by me, Jay Allison, with Vicki Merrick at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. This hour was produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. The Moth Radio Hour is presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.